Welcome one and all to the Autism Show with your current host, Lazy Lazzy. I'm standing in for DJ Mud Skipper and DJ Naima Money. Let's make sure that I'm not too loud. All right. We just want to have a nice ambiance in the background, some nice Lazy Lazzy music. So subbing in for DJ Mud Skipper, DJ Naima Money. Shout out always. And I believe it's a PA show, so following views presented in this hour do not reflect the views of KDVS, KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. You know the spiel. Today we have a nice restful show with some background music, hopefully not playing too loud. Let's see how loud that is. Hope everybody is free from finals, free from all of the burdensome, free from all of the burdens of getting through finals week, last week. And for all of those who are not students, I wish you the best of luck, especially getting through holidays. I hope you get plenty of time off, and if you don't, well, then I know KDVS will be here right for you. So, today I want to read a little bit about this book, The Underworld. Let's get a little bit of a more mood setting. I think something a little bit more classical, maybe, just to fit with the reading theme. So, let's see. You know, getting through finals was a big relief for your host, Lazy Lazzy. I'm sure for some of those listeners as well. What a week. All right. I think I have a lovely tune for y'all. Little bit of Franz Liszt. Little bit of Liszt. Let us jump right into it. So, The Underworld. Journeys to the Depths of the Ocean by Susan Casey. The Underworld. For those who love the ocean. Do we have any ocean lovers out there? If you are an ocean lover, feel free to call into the station at 530-754-KDVS. If you so feel inclined, if you are an ocean lover, we must go and see for ourselves. That is Jacques-Yves Cousteau. I don't know who that is, but that's in the little notes at the beginning. When writing about the deep ocean, the first question that arises is, what is it? At what point does the ocean become the deep ocean? It may be surprising to learn that even deep sea scientists don't fully agree on how to define the various depth zones. Typically, however, the deep ocean is considered to comprise the waters below 200 meters, or approximately 600 feet, the point at which sunlight essentially disappears. In this book, I have defined the deeper layers as the twilight zone, 600 to 3,300 feet, the midnight zone, 3,300 to 10,000 feet, the abyssal zone, 10,000 to 20,000 feet, and the hadal zone, 20,000 to 30,000 feet. Spooky. These names and measurements are commonly used, although there are other ways to delineate the deep's regions, particularly within its vast mid-waters. The abyssal zone is known in short as the abyss, but the word abyss also has a broader deep meaning as a deep and seemingly bottomless chasm. It's often used when referring generally to the ocean's great depths. You'll find both usages in these pages with the distinction evident in context. You could travel through the abyssal zone in a submersible, though few vehicles in the world can venture that deep. But if you were traveling in a submarine, you wouldn't have that option. Submarines are capable of sustained, independent undersea operations, but their diving range is relatively shallow. The deep sea vehicles I describe in these pages are all submersibles. There are two types, manned and unmanned. Manned submersibles carry passengers who sit within a dry, pressure-controlled atmosphere equipped with life support systems. These compact subs can descend, ascend, and fly around beneath the surface independently, but they require a support vessel and crew for transport, launch, and recovery. Their power supplies come from batteries, so they can't remain submerged for weeks the way a submarine can. Unmanned submersibles are robots, and include remote-operated vehicles, ROVs, that are tethered to a ship and driven remotely by a human pilot, and autonomous underwater vehicles, AUVs, that may also be launched from a ship, but are pre-programmed to dive, collect data, and return to their base without real-time human input. In casual usage, the words submarine and submersible are sometimes used interchangeably, referring generally to an underwater vehicle. Both submarines and submersibles share an abbreviation, subs. The deep ocean occupies 95% of the ocean's volume, and you'll notice that both terms are singular. The Earth possesses one ocean, though it's traditionally recognized as having five major regions: the Pacific, Atlantic, Indian, Arctic, and Southern Oceans. Whenever possible, I refer to the ocean as a single entity. The science of measuring the seabed terrain is known as bathymetry, the submarine version of topography. Bathymetric maps chart the depths and contours of the seafloor in three-dimensional relief, revealing its mountains, valleys, canyons, plains, rifts, trenches, and other undersea features. American and British readers are accustomed to thinking in miles, feet, tons, degrees, Fahrenheit, pounds per square inch. Science uses metric measurements. Mariners use nautical miles and fathoms. Here, I'm defaulting to the imperial system of measurement, but when it is helpful for clarity, I've cited metric figures. Metric usage in quotes is verbatim. To the underworld. Before we hop into the underworld, wait, it is currently 4:37. Oh, so I don't need to worry too much about, what would that be? Ah, okay, wonderful. Going into the prologue. My dear child, how did you come to this land of darkness while still alive? It is hard for the living to get here. Homer, the Odyssey. In the Pacific Ocean, I'm not going to read the latitude, longitude, that seems a little hard to remember. January 31st, 2021. I stood on the ship's deck in my long underwear and my fireproof jumpsuit, watching a pale silver sunrise and gauging the wind. It was blowing 20 knots, gusting to 30, and it had been blowing this hard all night, churning the ocean into a disorderly mess. What I wanted to know, and had come outside to check, was how disorderly. I could see that the waves were trouble, 10-foot swells galloping from two directions, surging with white caps. They'd run halfway across the Pacific, gaining strength along the way. Out here, there was no land to stop them. Bracing myself against a railing, I took out my phone to check the marine forecast again. Today, to me, every knot of wind speed and every inch of wave height mattered. 2 hours from now, at 0800, conditions permitting, a team of engineers, technicians, and mariners would attempt to launch an 11-ton deep-sea submersible with two people in it, and I would be one of them. If the launch was successful, the sub would bob at the surface briefly. The pilot would pump seawater into the ballast tanks, and then we would sink beneath the waves and free fall for 2.5 hours, plunging for miles and touching down in a place that human eyes had never seen. That was the plan. But right now, the conditions didn't seem very permissive. In order for the dive to go forward, the weather would have to lie down. If we didn't dive today, it was unclear if I'd get another chance, and I had been waiting for this one my entire life. In all of history, few had ventured as deep as we were going. There was a long list of reasons why, a roster of difficulties and risks, the most obvious being that at the bottom we would encounter 8,000 pounds of pressure per square inch. For oxygen, communications, navigation, shelter, survival, we'd be utterly reliant on the sub. It was a singular machine, the first submersible that could dive repeatedly with a pilot and passenger to full ocean depth, 36,000 feet. So new and innovative that its creators still referred to it as a prototype. To put the Deep's engineering challenges into perspective, consider that there are three Mars rovers, while this sub was one of a kind. But the inaccessibility of the Deep, I thought, made it even more alluring. Others wanted to visit Paris, Bora Bora, the Serengeti. I wanted to go into the ocean's abyss. The idea of an unknown aquatic realm, ever present below us, but invisible unless we look for it, an underworld within our world, had always worked a sort of spell on me, an alchemical mix of wonder and fear. It may seem as if those emotions would cancel each other out, but the opposite is true. When you add them together, you get the sublime, which transcends both. The passion caused by the great and sublime in nature is astonishment, wrote the 18th century philosopher Edmund Burke. And astonishment is the state of the soul in which all its motions are suspended with some degree of horror. But, he added, it was a sort of delightful horror. The abyss might be terrifying, but you wouldn't notice because you'd be too busy gaping in awe. At least that's how I imagined it, and I wanted to see if I was right. To tell you the story of how I landed on this ship, ready to climb into the world's most extreme submersible, I have to go back to the beginning. My obsession with the Deep started early. In childhood, I had a recurring dream in which I floated on a moonlit sea in a small boat, while below me big fish circled ominously, or swept by like phantoms. The dream was haunting, but I never thought of it as a nightmare. Beneath the one-way mirror of the surface, anything might be lurking. But even if it scared me, I was determined to check it out. In the 70s, when the undersea world of Jacques Cousteau was at its zenith, I would sit in front of the TV and watch, riveted, as Cousteau and his jaunty band of aquanauts descended into coral forests and grottos filled with hungry sharks. During the episode where the Calypso sailed to the South Pacific so the crew could explore sunken World War II wrecks in a lagoon, you couldn't have pried me away from the screen if the house were on fire. To roam around the globe in your own ship, diving into one mystery after another, represented a kind of idealized existence that not only seemed unattainable, it hardly seemed real. That didn't make the show any less fabulous, though. It allowed me to join the expeditions vicariously, from the safety of land. This was important because for all my desire to visit the undersea world myself, I didn't learn how to swim until I was almost 10, and even then, I was shaky about it. I grew up in a suburb of Toronto, far from the ocean, but close to hundreds of Canadian shield lakes, gouged from Precambrian granite by lumbering glaciers. These northern lakes appear brooding, even somber. Their waters are an inky green black, shadowed by the craggy bluffs and boreal forests that surround them. Rock shoals rise to form islands offshore, attended by lichens and pines, and serenaded by loons. My family spent summers at a place called Port Severn, 2 hours north of the city. It is tucked along the southeastern shore of Georgian Bay and Lake Huron, the second largest of the Great Lakes. To my 10-year-old mind, Port Severn was a place full of dark intrigue. I would stand at the end of the dock and look down into the water and see no sign of the bottom, and envision the animals that lived in its depths. There were northern pikes with beady eyes and torpedo bodies, their jaws lined with needle teeth, and muskies, pikes on steroids that had been known to attack children. Sturgeons, with their bony armor, looked like the offspring of a catfish and a crocodile. They could grow as big as a canoe. Within walking distance of our cottage, there was an old boathouse, unused and derelict, with a wooden door that groaned when you opened it. Inside, it was gloomy and cobwebby with a rickety U-shaped dock and a musty smell of mildew. The whole structure listed to starboard. In its cave-like, half-sunk end life, the boat cave-like half-sunned end life, the boathouse was an ideal lair for reclusive giant fish. At dusk, I would sneak in with a flashlight and drop bits of food in the water, hoping to coax them to the surface. Most of the time, there were no takers. Then, one day, I tossed in a scrap of hot dog and a great beast of a fish. It had to be 4 feet long, emerged from under the dock, raised its head, and lunged at the meat before quickly retreating. In the dim beam of the flashlight, I could make out only the fish's silhouette, but that was enough. It was the coolest thing I'd ever seen, and proof of concept. The underworld was alive with surprises. Let's see. Wonderful. I think we could finish a chapter today. It was about the water. Always the water. Nothing else had the same magnetism. Nothing else even came close. It was irresistibly drawn to it. I was irresistibly drawn to it. And I developed skills I needed to immerse myself in the aquatic world. I became a serious competitive swimmer, then an open water swimmer, free diver, scuba diver. The Pacific Ocean became my favorite playground, the largest waters on Earth. I moved to Hawaii to be closer to my muse, and she rewarded me by letting me swim with her residents. Sharks, whales, dolphins, sea turtles, eels, fish, marine creatures I'd never encountered before, each possessed of a presence that mesmerized me like nothing found on land. The sheer unearthliness of everything that was happening between the waves rocked my world. It was plainly an empire that only the ocean could rule, an ungovernable territory that begins where the sunlight stops. It's out of sight, but once it allows you a peek at its majesty, it's never out of mind. I wanted to know more. I wanted to see more. I wanted to dive into the darkness. Somewhere in those waters, I'd crossed a threshold, stepped through the doorway of the craziest boathouse of all, and now I wanted to go deeper. When you're compelled by something, I think you owe it to yourself to go out and investigate it. But my desire for deep-sea submergence came with some technical obstacles. Musing about the abyss felt like falling in love with a mirage. An image flickers into mind, then dissolves, and as ungraspable as water itself. Who has known the ocean? Neither you nor I, with our earthbound senses. The marine biologist and author Rachel Carson lamented. I understood that frustration, yet still I felt the deep's pull. Limited to the ocean's top 100 feet, as I was, the real abyss eluded me, as if it were an abstraction rather than a destination. It glittered in my imagination like a distant galaxy, about as tangible as a blast of radio waves. What kind of place was it? What was it like to be there? What would you see if you went? Even now, when every last crater on the moon has been named and interactive three-dimensional maps of Mars can be viewed on an iPhone, 80% of the seafloor has never been charted in any kind of sharp detail. Yet the deep ocean, defined as the waters below 600 feet, covers 65% of the Earth's surface and occupies 95% of its living space. The Pacific alone could swallow every landmass, every continent and island, and still have room for another South America. The deep isn't merely a part of our planet. It is our planet. You'd think we would want to be more familiar with it. Our awareness of the ocean typically stops at its uppermost layer, known as the epipelagic or sunlight zone. If you see marine life and you can name it, odds are it swims in these shallows. But the epipelagic occupies only 5% of the ocean's volume. For all its loveliness, it's merely a ceiling. The real action takes place below. That's where you'll find the twilight zone, from 600 to 3,300 feet, with its menagerie of creatures that twinkle and glow with bioluminescence, followed by the midnight zone from 3,300 to 10,000 feet, and the abyssal zone, 10,000 to 20,000 feet. Wrap around layers of eternal night, populated by marvelous weirdos. The intersection where these waters meet the seafloor is known as the abyssal plain, a sediment-cloaked flatland that hosts extraordinary and subtle life. Although these plains may seem quiet, they're often interrupted by outbursts of geological drama. This is the bottom of the world, but the descent isn't over yet. Beneath the abyss lies the Hadal Zone, named after Hades, the Greek god of the underworld and brother of Poseidon, and his mystical realm of the dead. Hadal waters start at 20,000 feet and pitch down into dozens of ultra-deep trenches and troughs, the vast majority of which are located in the Pacific, shaped like the inverted summits of Himalayan peaks. The deepest of them is the Mariana Trench, a 1,500-mile-long, 44-mile-wide gash in the seabed near Guam. It's home to the 35,876-foot Challenger Deep, the ocean's absolute nadir. Nadir? I've never heard of that word before. I'm going to write that word down. What a fancy word nadir is. I wonder what it could mean. By comparison, Mount Everest is 29,000 feet high. These great depths are a shadow kingdom. In the past, they were the blank spots on the map that carried the old warning, "Here be dragons." Although now we're quite sure the abyss is dragon-free, it still has a mythical aura. Even the slightest glimpse of it is fascinating, because it doesn't reveal itself easily. Actually, it doesn't reveal itself at all, unless we approach it with serious technology. The only way to get a clear picture through thousands of feet of liquid darkness is with sound, which travels faster and farther through water than it does through air. This technology is known as acoustic imaging, or sonar, bouncing sound waves off the bottom and measuring the speed of their return. By processing these data, we can build a refined three-dimensional model of the seafloor. This can't be done from afar. To map an area, the sonar array must pass directly over it. Making precise bathymetric maps is a highly technical affair, and in most places in the ocean, no one has ever tried, or even tried. Our lack of a seafloor atlas lends itself to some startling discoveries, and in 2017, one of them ignited my curiosity. In my efforts to learn more about the abyss, I had been tracking the science, reading books, watching documentaries. I pored over any deep-sea news, so I was primed to notice when this headline came along. Search for MH370 unveils a lost world deep beneath the ocean. Like millions of others, I'd followed the story of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370's disappearance with a sinking heart and a long list of questions, and I believed that, eventually, those questions would be answered. How could they not be? To simply lose a jumbo jet and its 239 passengers was inconceivable. But as the years ticked by without a resolution, and pieces of MH370's torn wings washed up on East African beaches, it was evident that the Indian Ocean had claimed it. And she doesn't answer to us. To make matters more complicated, the plane was thought to have gone down in the Indian Ocean's remote southern reaches, where gale winds rake across waters up to 23,000 feet deep. On March 8, 2014, the night MH370 vanished, nobody knew much about that area, except that it wasn't friendly. The only hints of what the seafloor might look like were models derived from satellite altimetry. By measuring gravity's effects on the sea surface, you can infer the depth and contours of the underlying terrain. Above a large seamount, for instance, the surface bulges perceptibly. Above a trench or an other depression, it's subtly lower. Blurry and low resolution, the gravity models were more like estimates than facts. To have any hope of pinpointing the jet's wreckage, better information was needed. What followed was the biggest, deepest, hardest, longest, most technically ambitious, and extensive deep-sea search ever conducted. For 1,046 days, the searchers scoured the abyss with robots and high-resolution sonar, creating crisply detailed three-dimensional maps of the deep across an area the size of New Zealand. They found four shipwrecks and identified one of the... The searchers had descended far to retrieve what they sought, and then had to return to the surface without it. But a catabasis is never a wasted journey. It always offers a dose of the phenomenal. According to the news article that caught my eye, this one was no exception. The maps revealed that the southern Indian Ocean seafloor was spectacularly, eerily beautiful. It was a symphony of extremes, a playlist of geology's greatest hits. It was as if we had discovered Tolkien's Middle Earth 4 miles underwater. There were mountains taller than Swiss Alps, valleys that dwarfed Yosemite, yawning crevices, vertical cliffs that plunged into chasms. The seabed was slashed with scars left by the supercontinent Gondwana when it broke into pieces, creating Australia, India, and Antarctica. 100 million years ago, during Gondwana's long crack-up, a gargantuan volcanic rift in the seafloor opened up like a zipper. Fiery magma from the Earth's mantle poured into it, swelling into a huge mass of igneous rock that morphed and changed shape over time, rising and falling and twisting and tearing as two tectonic plates pulled apart. This split resulted in a 750-mile-long fracture zone flanked by a serrated escarpment, another fun word, escarpment, that plummets deep, plummets 17,000 feet, passing 6 canyons on the way down, bottoming out in one of the Indian Ocean's deepest spots, the Diamantina Trench. If you were to walk across the Diamantina Trench, your feet would sink into soft sediment, the accumulation of millions of years of marine snow, bits and flecks of dead sea creatures, tiny skeletons and tinier shells, plankton, bacteria, organic waste, silt, and these days, microplastics, that slowly wafts down from above. Not all of the bottom is oozy, however. In one adjacent area, geologists counted 154 volcanoes, and 17 of them topped 3,300 feet, which qualifies them as seamounts, full-fledged, freestanding mountains. Many were encircled by moats that had been dug by surprisingly strong currents, and as currents swept by, they circulate food. In the deep, hunting for something to eat is a full-time job, and the seamounts serve as oases that attract a riot of unique species. Creatures would be everywhere in this terrain, wedged into crevices, blossoming on the rocks, swimming around, burrowed into sediment. And south of these peaks was another epic feature, the Gilvink Fracture Zone, a 3,000-foot-deep cleft in the seabed that runs so straight for so long, it looks like someone drew it with a ruler. I'm going to end our autism show today with that. This has been your host, Lazy Lazy, and you are currently listening to KDVS Davis, 90.3 FM. If you so feel like it, please tune in tomorrow for my shows, I believe, at 9 to 9:30, and then I have a whole block from 3 to 5 p.m., and so if you're in the mood to listen to more Lazy Lazy, I will be having both talk shows and music shows. Thank you all for your audience, and this is Lazy Lazy signing out.